Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Literature brings us epic stories of passion, revenge, power, love, and the power to place ourselves in life, says my guest today. Youth, middle age, old age, they can all go by in a blur. But William Faulkner has paused to think and share what they mean. So has Alice Walker, Sophocles, William Blake, Proust, Virginia Woolf, Toni Morrison. We can read and know ourselves. We are where we are in life. This hour On Point, examining our life stages in literature. You can join the conversation. Who do you trust to light the way? Dr. Phil, Oprah, or Balzac, the Brontes, Arthur Miller, Will Shakespeare? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Providence, Rhode Island, is Arnold Weinstein, professor of comparative literature at Brown University. His new book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life's Stages Through Books. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Arnold Weinstein, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a terrific treat and tour, and treat's too small a word. You say it's funny that the testimony of literature is rarely invoked these days as a tool of personal discovery, but it should be.
That's right. I think that too often literature is thought of as high culture, frills, distraction. But in fact, I'm confident that it really functions as a kind of mirror. It helps us see not just who we are, but where we've been, how we became who we are, and conceivably points towards where we may be going.
You've framed this big look at literature, and you've had many in a long career, but you framed this one in terms of our kind of progress through life. I suppose, what are you doing in that case? Just catching the insights that a great writer finds on a particular point, stringing them together like beads of insight for us?
There is a lot of that, and certainly the books that are fine books have these insights. On the other hand, you can't always locate it in a particular passage or a page. Often it's the actual curve of the book. I mean, after all, stories pack lives. They pack the curve of time in 200, 300 pages, whereas it takes us 60, 80 years to live that long. So that there's a sense in which art reveals the curve of our life, the shape of our life, our passage through time, trajectory, in ways that our own eyes, our retina, can't take in at all. So it's the books as a whole, as well as some marvelous passages, it seems to me, that are really illuminating.
You've got some very contemporary citations in here, as well as some that go way, way back. And you open up with Sophocles and Oedipus and the riddle of the Sphinx right at the beginning. Talk about the stages of life. They're all there.
Well, the riddle of the Sphinx, of course, is the most talked about riddle in the world. And many people wonder why people think it's so difficult. In other words, it seems pretty self-evident to us that man is the answer. What's less self-evident?
This is the riddle from the Sphinx where he says,
right.
What is the creature that is on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, three legs at night? And, of course, Oedipus answers, thinking of the infant and the adult and the perhaps an elder with a cane, man.
That's right, man.
And becomes king, marries the queen, and all because he understood the riddle.
That's correct. He wins the prize. He is obviously answering his own story. But the word that's never mentioned here is time itself. In other words, the human beings are the only creatures that go through different means of locomotion over time. We change our way of moving. We do start out on four legs, then on two, and then on three in some sense. And each of those passages, each of those phases has its narrative, has its story, has its values, challenges, pleasures.
So the gift that literature brings in terms of understanding ourselves at each age is a kind of a torch or flashlight to look through the murk that can surround us without these clarifying insights.
That's right. It helps us. I think of it also as a repertoire, that when we read books, we inevitably are encountering, in some sense, ingesting stories of other lives. We live again, in some sense, with the stories that we read. And therefore, these are might-bes or might-have-beens. There's even older stories, going back to Sophocles or Shakespeare, that these are stories that certainly take place in their own moment, but they also echo or resonate or illuminate our own conditions. I mean, a lot of this is pretty generic. People do start out as babies and then young people and then in the middle of their lives, and then they get old, and then they get older, and then they approach dying. I mean, that we personalize that with our own stories and existences, but of course, it's a pretty generic story in itself.
You've got so many great passages here, and the insights are nothing. They may be shared, but they hardly feel generic. I wonder if you'd humor me to start at the end. There's the chorus, Sophocles' chorus from Oedipus, where he's describing, he's talking about the end of life and the folly of those who wish to go on too long, and sort of some brutal truths about the end of life. I wonder if you could read a bit from that for us.
Happy to. It's not a particularly happy passage, but no. I think it gets our attention. Mm-hmm. Show me a man who longs to live a day beyond his time, who turns his back on a decent length of life. I'll show the world a man who clings to folly. For the long, looming days lay up 1,000 things closer to pain than pleasure, and the pleasures disappear. You look and know not where. When a man's outlived his limit, plunged in age, and the good comrade comes who comes at last to all, not with a wedding song, no lyre, no singers dancing, the doom of the death god comes like lightning, always death at the last. Not to be born is best when all is reckoned in. But once a man has seen the light, the next best thing by far is to go back where he came from, quickly as he can. For once his youth slips by, light on the wing, light-headed, what mortal blows can he escape? What griefs won't stalk his days? Envy and enemies, rage and battles, bloodshed, and last of all, despised old age overtakes him. Stripped of power, companions, stripped of love, the worst this life of pain can offer, old age, our mate at last. It's a harsh passage. It actually,
no kidding. Talk about telling it like it is.
But you know, we think
at least a tough version. Wow.
We think we die completely alone in some bizarre fashion. He has said, no. You do have a mate at the very end. It may not be the one you had wanted, but that this is your final companion. And I think even the stripping there is rather fascinating. That all of the accoutrements, all of the things that we have thought were ours in terms of assets and possessions, all of that is stripped away from us. We are really naked at the end. And then comes this final encounter with our mate, death.
And harsh in his insights along the way, or his view, not to be born is best. And then, and I guess this must be rich coming from Oedipus, in a sense, go back to where you came from. Of course, he who famously slept unknowingly with his mother. But go back to death. You're better off there.
That's right. Or go back to the womb, or go back to unbeing. Mm-hmm. Perhaps this is what at some subliminal level was motivating him. One doesn't know. A Freudian would probably argue that. But certainly none of us does have the choice of going back. And so I suppose that the residual wisdom is, well, in that case, don't go on too long. Right, don't outlive your stay.
We can go back right here, right now. You've taught for years to your students in university about the literature of youth and of becoming, of coming of age. I guess I read you here saying they have zero interest in these passages about death when you take them on.
They think of it as science fiction, I believe. It doesn't quite resonate for them.
But at the other end, when we're talking about passages from literature that might light up a young life, what do you find compelling?
Well, of course, the first thing that's compelling is that any story of young lives inevitably gets the attention of young students. And it's secondly the case that it really performs something of the same role that these stories of growing old do, which is to say, it functions as a mirror. These young people, after all, that I teach at university, 18, 22 years old, they're poised for a life beyond the university. They're being credentialed. And many of these stories, in a sense, give them a foreshadowing, a possible set of outcomes, of horizons, that they're going to have to negotiate themselves, and they don't have the answers yet. So I choose a range of texts to illustrate these passages for young people, and they're often about how young people really do not understand their worlds. After all, we're not born understanding our culture, our society, or even the values that have come into us without our knowing it. Many of the most wonderful books, I'm thinking of Huckleberry Finn or some of William Blake's poems, show us how it is we have absorbed values and assumptions, never knowing it, never seeing it, but they're in us. We didn't choose them. And then life all of a sudden causes us to question them. Are they ours? Do we really believe in them? We're just now beginning to see them.
And you write, and I stole this from you, but you say, my book addresses a poverty so basic, so elemental that we do not even realize it afflicts us. We do not possess our own lives. Meaning that our understanding is just that slight, we're just drifting?
It's hard to get an optic or a perspective. No one has a panoptic view of their lives. Well, think about the documents that people have in their safe deposit boxes or what they write in their resumes. All of these pieces, none of them conveys or evokes the wholeness of a life. I think everybody at some point yearns to see the pattern of their life, what Henry James called the figure in the carpet, or to use a musical term, to find the melody of their lives. And that would mean having some somewhat plenary, fuller sense of who you are, who you've been, how you became who you are, as I said. And I believe that we're not easily equipped to have that on our own.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life stages and the lessons of literature, what the greats tell us about growing up and growing old, with Arnold Weinstein of Brown University, author of Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. He says, we yearn for a clearer, more dimensional record of who we are. We can find our form in books, and almost this challenge, raid the huge storehouse of life stories that go by the name of literature. We're looking to do that right here today. Arnold, I wonder if you'd read a Toni Morrison passage for us from Sula, her 1973 book. You mentioned Huck Finn and the kind of coming into awareness that many of us know well from him and his deeper understanding of Jim along with him on the Mississippi. But here's Toni Morrison with Sula, where there's not only awareness, but there's determination found in youth. I wonder if you could take us into some of that.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Sula is published early in Morrison's career. It's 1973. It goes like this. They walked up the street until they got to the bend of Carpenter's Road, where the boys lounged on a disused well. Spotting their prey, the boys sauntered forward as though there were nothing in the world on their minds but the gray sky. Hardly able to control their grins, they stood like a gate blocking the path. When the girls were 3 feet in front of the boys, Sula reached into her coat pocket and pulled out Eva's paring knife. The boys stopped short, exchanged looks, and dropped all pretense of innocence. This was going to be better than they thought. They were going to try to fight. And with a knife. Maybe they could get an arm around one of their waists or tear. Sula squatted down in the dirt road and put everything down on the ground, her lunch pail, her reader, her mittens, her slate. Holding the knife in her right hand, she pulled the slate toward her and pressed her left forefinger down hard on its edge. Her aim was determined, but inaccurate. She slashed off only the tip of her finger. The four boys stared open-mouthed at the wound and the scrap of flesh, like a button mushroom, curling in the cherry blood that ran into the corners of the slate. Sula raised her eyes to them. Her voice was quiet. If I can do that to myself, what do you suppose I'll do to you?
Arnold Weinstein reading from Toni Morrison's Sula. That's 1973, and of course that picture, Sula, the main character, kind of wild child, born into a lawless family, walking along, a young black girl, runs into a group of young kids, white bully boys, and she's ready to cut off her own finger to
and
show.
And does so.
And
at least
does
a peso.
So.
Yes. It's, you know, she is one of the feistiest characters that Morrison ever created, and she's unstoppable, as we see. This is one of the earliest moments where we do see it in this novel, and she's irresistible as a character. It's worth saying that I believe that this book hypnotized Morrison herself. At one point, Morrison says that Sulla's life was an experimental life. And I think Morrison wanted to measure how far a strong-willed, unstoppable, courageous, determined girl like this might go. And in the book, we see how far she does go. And it's not pretty at times that she goes on at one point to climb a tree and take this young boy, Chicken Little, with her. Mm. And as they're descending the tree, she swings him out over the river and then lets go. And we see him sort of fly over the river, fall into the river, and drown. So she has a death on her hands. And then there are further things that happen. I mean, she just becomes more and more trouble for this community.
How do your young audiences, your college students, take on the example of Sulla? I mean, here they are. She's up against bullies in this passage. They're up against a lot in their lives. How do they respond to that sort of absolute fearless posture that she's trying?
I think one side of them has to be awed, enamored, delighted. And I'm sure one side of them says, well, it's a good thing this is only happening in a book. Because I, particularly the ones that end up at Brown University, I don't think are taking the kinds of chances that we see in a figure like Sulla. Sulla is fearless. There is a kind of raw will to power in Sulla that Morrison essentially wants to liberate, to see how far it might go. When Sulla later comes back, she ends up messing up other people's lives, including that of her best friend. She takes her best friend's husband, has an affair with him. She tells off her grandmother and it institutionalizes her, and she dies alone. It's not necessarily a happy career, but it's a bold career. My students, I think, feel very mixed about this. This is not a pattern that anybody has told them to copy.
And yet, the road we're on, their lives may yet bring them some challenges where they could use a little bit of that incredible grit. Alicia is calling. Let's turn to our listeners, if I may, in Boston, South Boston. Hi, Alicia. You're on the air with Arnold Weinstein.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Professor Weinstein. I was a student of your twin brother at Swarthmore College in 1997. He also teaches literature. And in his modern comparative literature class, we studied Beloved, which is another of Toni Morrison's greats.
Sure.
And I wanted to just get your take on, I've also taught Beloved as an English teacher myself since at a private school in Cambridge. And I was always struck, your line of thinking here seems to be that we can, in this sort of tripartite grouping of human beings in infancy and then in manhood or womanhood and then in old age, Beloved as a central character who's a ghost sort of returning from beyond brings this sort of fourth element that I always found fascinating myself, but that students really responded to also as a way of, it's almost a visitation from the beyond, and there was so much to learn about the human experience, especially in slavery, in this fourth, almost the fourth stage of life, the afterlife, and what is that and what can we learn from that?
Fourth stage, beyond morning, noon, and night, midnight.
That's right.
What about it?
That's right. Well, I'm delighted that you have worked with my brother. You must think you're listening to him. Our voices are exactly the same. I think that Beloved is, in my view, Morrison's masterpiece. I love Sulla. Sulla is a feisty, prancing kind of novel. Beloved is a dense, tragic novel. It does go to the fourth stage, I suppose. It's not the afterlife, though. I mean, what's shocking about Morrison is how literal she can be. This is not a ghost. This is a person who comes back who has a body. And, of course, she comes back to a family where her mother has murdered her to save her. These are paradoxes that it's very difficult to get your head or your heart around. So I think that Morrison is, in my view, one of America's very, very greatest writers. I believe that the kind of freedom and the kind of quest for pure freedom that you see in a book like Sulla, and that you could even see in that little episode that I quoted, is now being reconsidered in a much graver fashion in Beloved. And, of course, she's chosen a historical moment in American life, the aftermath of slavery. But she's getting at the kind of root, I think, horror of slavery, which is that you did not own your body, and yet you were nothing but a body, that you didn't have a family, that you didn't have a spouse, that your siblings weren't yours, that your masters possessed and owned all of that. And I think she shows us what a kind of absolute poverty that is, how decimating that is for human beings. Those are complex, mature, tragic issues that, for better or for worse, we don't find in a book like Sulla.
And may only find in a book like Sulla. Alicia, thank you for your call. Arnold Weinstein writes, education in school is outward, generic, anonymous, unattuned to the ongoing private voyage we're making every minute, and that's where he finds literature as a guide. I wonder if we can go to some middle age insight here. You've got a passage from Virginia Woolf, To the Lighthouse, 1927 novel. Of course, Mrs. Ramsey here in To the Lighthouse is considered maybe a portrait of Woolf's mother, who died when Woolf was just 13. And there's a passage where she's just put her son James to bed after helping him cut some pictures from a book. She sits down to knit and talking about, I mean, if the scales fall away from the eyes one way and another in youth, in Huck Finn and beyond, here she's having to go within. She sees the world around her. It can consume her. She's going within to find her life.
It's quite lovely. It's a famous passage, by the way, too. Mm. No, she thought, putting together some of the pictures he had cut out, a refrigerator, a mowing machine, a gentleman in evening dress. Children never forget. For this reason, it was so important what one said and what one did. And it was a relief when they went to bed. For now, she need not think about anybody. She could be herself, by herself. And that was what she often felt the need of, to think, well, not even to think, to be silent, to be alone. All the being and the doing, expansive, glittering, vocal, evaporated, and one shrunk with a sense of solemnity to being oneself, a wedge-shaped core of darkness, something invisible to others. Although she continued to knit and sat upright, it was thus that she felt herself. And this self, having shed its attachments, was free for the strangest adventures. It's such a marvelous passage because first of all, the students that I teach, the women students that I teach today, I don't think that Mrs. Ramsey is a very obvious role model. Their mothers and even their grandmothers are frequently professional women. Mm-hmm. Here we have a woman entirely defined by her domestic roles as a mother and as a wife. It's why it matters that this passage has to do with her tending to her son James. And yet, no woman today either, or very few, can easily or comfortably be free of the potential tug of war between family and career. These things don't go away. And what I think is magnificent in what Woolf has written is that, and that's why I called it one of the adult examples in my mm-hmm. book, is that here is a woman who, yes, is a marvelous, and she is a marvelous mother and a wife, has much beauty in those two roles. She's also a person, and she's also a self, and she also has an inner realm, and even has inner dimensions. And that's what we see in this passage, that at some point she retreats into herself, becomes this wedge-shaped core of darkness, and then moves. It's as if, as a wedge-shaped core of darkness, mm-hmm. just with her own imagination, her feelings, her thoughts, she is able to enter into the world, to travel. And I'm putting it that way because we think today about, even now, I have headphones on, people mm-hmm. are wired, they're listening, that we think the way that we get extended into the world is technologically in some fashion. Here's a woman who doesn't have a screen, she doesn't have a monitor, and yet only with her thinking and feeling, she is in fact moving far into the world. And think too about the passage, the way it closes, that although she continued to knit and sat upright, if you or I had been there, Tom, and saw her,
we would see
is a woman knitting.
Mm-hmm. That's Whistler's
all we'd
mother.
See. Mm-hmm. We'd see a woman knitting who just put her child to bed. What you could not ever see with your eyes is this inner voyage as a wedge-shaped core of darkness that she's making. And, you know, too, I think it stands, if you think of it, it's really a perfect figure for reading itself. You look at someone reading a book, mm-hmm. what do you see? You see nothing. You see eyelids twitching. You see a person sitting still, probably sitting. And yet, you're not seeing what's happening. What's happening is that they're going somewhere.
And I'm thinking here, even if your students' mothers today are professional women or out of the house or whatever, still in the helter-skelter of modern life, there still seems to me, in this midlife phase, maybe in particular, that need, that hunger to just be that wedge-shaped imagination on strange adventures. The things that fill our days are not necessarily always the most fulfilling. She's untrammeled. It's almost an ecstatic, exalting freedom as she sits there in silence.
And I've been told that by many women who have said that the need for this type of either solitude, of being oneself instead of the many roles that one is obliged to play, including professional roles, is all the more paramount now, given how crowded life is and how many demands are put on people.
Let me get a call from New York, De Poyster, New York, and Sheila. Sheila, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Well, my comment is the thing with literature I find is that when I read it, nobody from outside is trying to fix me. I find that Oprah, Dr. Phil, all the talk show stuff, I found it very annoying because they're always coming from their point of view, who they think you should be, and all this stuff. And it's constant. Other people are in your business all the time. Our society seems to just dwell on putting your nose in your business and, like, too many cooks. I mean, that's what I feel like sometimes. There's too many cooks trying to fix me. But when I read, I can read it, absorb it, throw out what I don't want, and just be the type of person I would like to be. And it helps me respond to people who are really stepping over my personal threshold, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
And that's what I find about literature that's really nice.
Oh, Sheila, that's so terrific. Thank you so much for that. Arnold Weinstein, I mean, you point out the greatest literature is not really didactic. It's not telling you, like Dr. Phil, exactly how to be. It's showing how people might be, how you may be, how someone was, and letting you in freedom, as Sheila says, absorb and use it as you will.
That's right. It is never a how-to book. It's never a sermon. They're not trying. The books are not trying to fix you. And they don't even always have a bottom line. They are opportunities. They are travels that you could make. They're versions of yourself at some vicarious level that you can try out. I mean, you try out a literary text, a poem. I don't think you try out a mathematical theorem. You don't try out even a historical text. You read it. You absorb information. But with literature, it seems to me that your involvement in it really is imaginative. It's like trying on clothes. You put it on. You sample it. You see where it takes you. But it does not have demands on you. It's not coercive.
And as we move through time, it also helps us keep in touch maybe with different parts of our own life, a kind of storehouse. You remind us of Proust beautifully saying that we live on stilts, stilts that get longer each day of our life, stilts from which we must eventually fall. And you remind us that our own lives, as time passes, can grow distant from us. Maybe we find pieces of them again in literature.
It's true. I mean, literature does, certainly one of the virtues for someone old like me to read these children's books, or books about Huckleberry Finn, etc., is to gain another glimpse of a time that's long ago. I mean, occasionally I say that reading books is a form of time travel. There's nothing science fiction-like in it, that we return in some sense to our own past, our own childhood. We have an opportunity to relive. We all have the adage that cats have nine lives. I think that books extend all of our lives, and what a bargain they are, too. I mean, it's one of civilization's sweetest gifts, it seems to me.
Yeah, no kidding. Huck Finn there, thinking about Jim, the African-American, the one who he shouldn't have empathy for, but he's thinking in Twain about Jim with him all the time and helping him.
And it's hard for him to think that, yeah. Tom. I mean, his culture has told him that Jim is not a person, just an escaped slave. But his experience with Jim, which is so beautifully done by Twain, teaches him something quite different.
He says he feels, from what he's been told, if he sympathizes with the Jim, he'll go to hell. And finally decides, you know, I was trembling, Twain writes, because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things. And I note it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell. And off goes Huck Finn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about life stages and the lessons of literature this hour, what the greats tell us about growing up and growing old with Arnold Weinstein, professor of literature at Brown University. His new book is Morning, Noon, and Night. Let's go to Rob in Crozet, Virginia. Hi, Rob. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I guess I could say literature is sometimes wasted on the young. We force kids that are in high school, well, I think it's good we expose them, but in a way, suffering through Hamlet, as a freshman in high school, not really understanding why he's so distraught, not really understanding the sense of betrayal, but also the feeling that he needs to act and then have to make those acts. But when 30 years down the road, I read Hamlet again or I see it performed, I can more appreciate what it felt like to feel betrayal in my own life, to have to make decisions, maybe unpleasant ones, to have to put people aside, and becomes more real. And so I guess the sense is that, like in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. Reading great literature works, they allow you to know that you, what you're going through, other people have gone through, this is the course they took. Did it work out well? You know, what can I learn from this?
Rob, I love that. I mean, we've all had that experience of reading something young, maybe a forced read in school, then reading it again and seeing it entirely different, maybe richer way. But Arnold, what about the experience of, you know, when in the passage of life we intersect with a certain piece of literature?
I think that there's a huge amount of truth, the disturbing truth, in what your speaker just said. Because, yes, it's true that students are often obliged to read texts that seem either dull or are simply unmoving to them, and that later in life, when their own experiences have primed them in some sense to understand these materials, they have a totally different meaning. Does that mean we shouldn't teach these books? One should read Hamlet in high school. I think that a great teacher helps to make a difference. My daughter teaches Hamlet to her 16 and 17-year-old students with great success. So I think part of the blame here may be in the way that we fail to make these kinds of older stories meaningful and pertinent to young people. But there's no, how can a young person understand King Lear? I mean, if you don't know anything firsthand about getting old, then it has to seem just a bit abstract. But of course, the nice thing about books is that you can reread them. I mean, I think that every interesting book has to be reread. Certainly, you think that every painting you want to know something about, you need to look at many times. Certainly, any person that you care about, you don't think that one encounter is going to do the job. So it's not surprising that books, too, really do require and reward rereading, even though that goes counter to sort of the notches on the gun barrel approach that we've got to get these books done.
There's a parallel in real life that we see things that have happened or that we've done different ways depending where we are in life. There's a passage from Philip Roth's Everyman, I think it's around, I don't know, page 346, 50, somewhere in there, Arnold, where Philip Roth's Everyman is facing his coming death and he's confronting remorse for failing in some of the most important roles of his life. I wonder if you could read just a paragraph from that for us.
Okay. He saw himself racing in every direction at once through downtown Elizabeth's main intersection. The unsuccessful father, the envious brother, the duplicitous husband, the helpless son, and only blocks from his family jewelry store, crying out for the cast of kin on whom he could not gain, no matter how hard he pursued them. Mama, Papa, Howie, Nancy, Randy, Lonnie, if only I'd known how to do it. Can't you hear me? I'm leaving. It's over, and I'm leaving you all behind. And those, vanishing as fast from him as he from them, turned just their heads to cry out in turn, all too meaningfully, too late.
Ouch.
This is pretty harsh also.
There's no forgiveness even when he's crying out for it.
He's crying out. It's a splendid marathon image. It's that last marathon, not the New York one or the Boston one. It's the last one, and of course you can't win it. And I think that line, if only I'd known how to do it, it's a school line. No one taught me that. They didn't teach me how to be a good son or a good husband. They didn't teach me the things that now I regret horribly at the end of my life, knowing.
We're trying to figure it out along the way here through literature with Arnold Weinstein. Ryan in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Thank you for calling, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just thought I'd like to mention a piece of literature that I feel needs to be mentioned is A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
Yes.
It's about his time in the gulag, and, you know, it just kind of chronicles a day of of absolute horrid living. And sometimes when I think of the grind that I lived through,
this is Solzhenitsyn.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I lived through is nothing compared to that, and just how you can find simple pleasures in even the worst of conditions.
The lessons are by no means all pretty ones. Thank you for that, Ryan. Arnold, that's quite
true. It's an interesting example, I think. It's a book that I don't know well. It's one of my wife's favorite stories. And when he finds a piece of potato in his soup, this is happiness, that the good things particularly look good when everything around you is so bleak and deprived. There's a lot of wisdom in that, about knowing how to value the things that come your way. Even in the most, I think, bleak circumstances, there will be perhaps something that looks up. And I think Solzhenitsyn had a clear sense of that.
We're looking for exhilaration, maybe ecstatic insights, but also, I mean, here's a comment on our website, Arnold, from Grady. Let me read it in full. He says, "The power of imagination and the power of myth are available as a means to wisdom. But right now, we're living the dark side of false myth engineered to imprison minds," Grady writes. "These texts are more valuable in their description of the dark side than any other purpose. Flannery O'Connor was another American master, a bittersweet revelation. Amen to that. I'll never forget when the misfit explained, 'Ain't no real pleasure in this life.'" And Grady writes, Arnold, he writes, "Gaddafi and Newt Gingrich, even Bill Clinton, cling to this same untruth. It's not that there is no real pleasure, but that those drunk on the possibilities of disproportionate power thrive on the suffering of others, and their poison is contagious. Unless you're vaccinated, today's broadcast is our collective shot." Grady says, wow, okay.
That's quite a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, but there's no question that you've got plenty of inoculation or eye-opening to the dark side of life in the passages you cite.
That's right. Writers do. People have said happy love has no history. That is the dark side that frequently is explored. I do not think it's celebrated, but it's explored. And most of us, I think, when our back is against the wall, have to realize, yes, that dark side, we have some of that in us as well. I think even really bleak plays like The Oedipus or King Lear, which don't end well, nonetheless are plays that are exhilarating because they expand our sense of what living entails. And that's always a good thing, even if it brings the dark side to view.
Let me go to Lee in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lee, hi. Thanks. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Lee.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a wonderful show. Books are my passion. I wanted to say that I've studied King Lear at many stages in my life, including fairly late in life at graduate school. And I've always found it terrifying and fascinating and mysterious, but I'm late middle age, and I still don't know what message about old age could be taken from King Lear. I'd love to hear Professor Weinstein talk about it.
Oh, he's very into Lear. Speak to it, please, Professor.
A question that speaks to my heart. Let me start by quoting somebody else as a way of hiding. Freud marvelously said that Lear is about to make friends with the necessity of dying. Now, that's not a happy friendship, and it's not one that Lear pulls off all that well. But it is, I think, a very shrewd and profound perception about the play. It's about recognizing that the kinds of power that you have, and in some sense all of us in our prime are kings, that those kinds of power are always cued to a clock, that they do not go on forever, and that there must be some wisdom or at least grace in knowing how to exit the stage. Lear is going to take a crash course in that. He's going to be initiated into that. He initially gives away part of his kingdom to the daughters that don't love him. He says he will crawl unburdened to death. Well, he's going to learn how many burdens there are. And so it's brutal, it's violent, it's a very Oedipal story about the young devouring the old or the old trying to hold on to their station. But I believe that he really, Shakespeare is illuminating almost in the gutter, in the pit at times, the internecine war between old and young. Again, this is not happy. But here's the upside, it seems to me, and I don't want to be, flip about this. Lear, once he realizes that he has lost his power, Lear comes to understand something about the systemic abuse in his kingdom, that everywhere he looks, because now his eyes have been opened, he sees the strong devouring the weak, the wolf devouring the lamb. He realizes that this is the charade of civilization, even though it's usually propped up with sweet names and it's made to look like it's moral and ethical. And that, it's a blinding insight, it seems to me. It's one that's hard to live with. I mean, he goes mad at the end. It's a brutal play. It's hard to find something, any uplift in it. And yet it's nonstop learning. It's a man who comes, nothing will get you nothing, he says to Cordelia. Well, at the end of this play, he has found more than nothing. He has found something about the way the world works. He has been initiated into its workings, and that there is a kind of searing illumination of the way power is played out. And as I say, there's a kind of wisdom as well that the play breathes, even though Lear can't follow it. And it's the same thing, Tom, that we saw in the passage in Oedipus about there is a time to exit, not to outstay your visit.
You say in the book that these insights from literature, they hearten us in a way, but they do and should also rattle us because of their clarity, because of their honesty.
That's right. And again, that's why the Huck Finn passage is so strong, that they rattle us in a sense that they challenge us about our own pieties or our own certainties or the things that we take to be normal and natural. And I believe that all of these books are, in that sense, unsettling. They're all about discoveries. Blake's terms for that were innocence and experience. Experience always surprises us. It rarely just confirms what we know to be true. It frequently undoes things that we earlier believed.
There's a passage, very un-Hallmark card here, from Gabriel Garcia Marquez in 100 Years of Solitude. Oh, Lord, how I love that book. And there's a passage where Aureliano, excuse me, the sort of cold-hearted war colonel, is looking at his elderly mother and the distance he feels from, you know, the mother that Hallmark would present quite differently is really, really hits you. I wonder if you could read that.
Yeah, I like the Hallmark reference here. Her skin was leathery, her teeth decayed, her hair faded and colorless, and her look frightened. He compared her with the oldest memory he had of her, the afternoon when he had the premonition that a pot of boiling water was going to fall off the table, and he found her broken to pieces. In an instant, he discovered the scratches, the welts, the sores, the ulcers, and the scars that had been left on her by more than a half century of daily life. And he saw that those damages did not even arouse a feeling of pity in him. Then he made one last effort to search in his heart for the place where his affection had rotted away, and he could not find it. I'm afraid we're back on the dark side here. Every reader thinks that
pitiless.
That last sentence is going to end with uplift.
Yeah.
One final search in his heart, and he finds compassion. But no, he doesn't. This is not unrelated, I believe, to his career as a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
This same character draws a circle around himself and says, no one can approach me within 10 feet. His view that somehow he is being threatened by all other people. And I believe what this passage shows us is that it's not that others are going to kill him. He's already a dead man. I mean, one of the great nightmares is that you could still be living and have a dead heart. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a better passage to illustrate it.
Let's try and find a sweetheart here for a moment. Henry in Weston, Massachusetts. Henry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What do you know?
I was, as an undergraduate, I was in psychology, and I was lucky enough to have Eric Erickson as my thesis advisor, who
wow.
studied and wrote a lot about the stages of life.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I wanted to write about the evolution of love for an adolescent. And, you know, that's a huge subject for an undergraduate. And he said, well, let's use literature. And he suggested, among other books, that I look at Anna Karenina.
Mm-hmm.
Which I had read, and I'm rereading now, actually, as having a great example of adolescent love affairs, self-centered love affairs, and more mature love affairs. Anna and Vronsky being the sort of self-centered, immature version, and Kitty and Levin developing into a more mature version of how love could be. It was a great subject for a thesis and made a real impression on me.
Anna Karenina and an adolescent love. Henry, thank you for sharing that. And that from Eric Erickson, no less, the guidance. Are your students looking for that kind of guidance? Are they ready to go to love lessons?
Yes, they are. They probably have something to say on the topic as well. I'm interested in the reference to Tolstoy, because there are writers about younger love. One thinks of Wuthering Heights and books of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that Erickson would tell you to go to literature makes perfect sense to me. I mean, Freud always claimed that the theories that he was codifying were things that he first found in the great writers. so that the writers have been there first. I teach a course on literature and medicine at Brown, and it's always the case, I tell them, that the writers have all, the Book of Job, the Greek tragedies, they've always known about what it means to have a body, what it means to be in pain. That the great existential issues, even though we now divvy them up in disciplines and departments at the university, they're always found also by the great imaginative writers. So I think Erickson knew.
And it's not, it can be sweet, but even then, we are, you write that the act of reading can and should be a more savage and cannibalistic affair. Our basic encounter with art is outright elemental, akin to a blood transfusion.
Now, let me comment on that, Don, okay. That cannibals only ingest the bodies of warriors whom they respect. It's meant to, they mean to absorb the strength of their enemies. It's a sign of respect. That makes it a rather interesting parallel, it seems to me, with reading books. We read books to bring their strengths into us.
From art as a second life, as you describe it, art in literature here lighting up our own. This, I could do this all day long. It's tremendous fun and a great, great source to look back upon ourselves. Arnold Weinstein, we're really grateful to you for taking the time today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Arnold Weinstein of Brown University. His new book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books. You can read an excerpt at our website. It's really terrific. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.